Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Chris Pockle. Christopher Pockle, DVM, DACVB, received his veterinary degree from the University of Minnesota in 2002 and became board certified by the ACVB in 2010. Chris previously operated a house call behavior practice in the Minneapolis St. Paul area and is now the owner and lead clinician at the Animal Behaviour Clinic in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Pockle lectures regularly throughout the US and Canada, has taught courses at the University of Minnesota and the Virginia Maryland Regional College of Veterinary Medicine, and has authored several articles and book chapters on topics such as inter-cat aggression and pet selection for animal-assisted therapy. Without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Chris to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Chris, how are you?
You know, I'm doing fantastic, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me on the show today. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak and engage the conversation.
Oh, wonderful. And I was looking at my script and I turned around to look at you via Zoom, which we're using to record this call, and you just had the most humongous smile on your face. It's good to know. And that made me smile. So wonderful to, because we took a bit of time to get this video sorted out today. So I'm glad we did. And we can see each other and watch each other's body language and facial expressions, like massive smiles as we go throughout the audio recording. Let's dive in to the first question today, carrying on that gratitude which you so beautifully shared, and we are very grateful for you taking time out of your day and schedule to be with us. Chris, could you please take us back to where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training and share some stories from that time and maybe one of the first animals you ever used positive reinforcement with?
Absolutely. I would say that some of the initial introduction for me happened during vet school. I had the opportunity, unfortunately, not all of the veterinary students, even in the U.S. at this point, have access to full behavior courses. That's something we're working on. But I did have the great opportunity to have quite a few lectures and courses on behavior in veterinary school. And that gave me that first introduction to, you know, what are we even talking about when we start this conversation about positive reinforcement? And that was sort of the first moment of saying, the way that I initially learned and interacted with animals that I'd owned in the past probably wasn't the most effective method out there. And so that clinical knowledge that was coming through on the veterinary side of training got kind of meshed together with some instruction that I received from a group of really fantastic trainers in Minnesota that I met when I started to take my at that point pup. She's now since passed away, but my pup at that time was a young Great Dane that I had acquired through one of our courses at veterinary school, and was taking her through puppy classes and was exposed to a variety of techniques that really I had learned about and read about, but hadn't really had enough of an opportunity to really explore and practice in my own hands with an animal that I knew well. And so that really started to shape this experience and and taught me a lot about how to incorporate those techniques, not only into that, you know, 30-minute training session or that 45-minute training session on Tuesday evenings for puppy class, but how to actually integrate that information into those real life day-to-day interactions that I had with the animals in my home.
And you mentioned that during vet school and even now, there isn't necessarily great access to this information via the prescribed content that vet students have to learn. But you said there that it's coming. Can you give us a little bit of information about, firstly, why is it that you think this information isn't included as much as it is when vets are learning about behavior? And what kind of things do you think we might see in the future?
I think it's a great question. And I've got my own sort of theories about why I think some of the curriculums aren't currently incorporating behavior or why they haven't in the past. And I don't know if this is necessarily a viewpoint that's shared by everyone, but I'm happy to share my own thoughts. On one hand, I think that many of the individuals who are leading the curriculum and the decisions that need to be made surrounding what gets taught to current veterinary students, if they didn't have that opportunity to get that exposure themselves when they were going through veterinary school, they may not fully grasp just how important this information is and truly how much of it needs to be incorporated into day-to-day veterinary practice in order for our students and then clinicians to be successful. So I think in some cases, there's a lack of recognition of the importance of the information. And there's sometimes a bit of a discrepancy between thinking, well, if we're not training quote-unquote behaviorists, then maybe we don't need to teach about behavior. When, you know, especially as we're learning more about the various methods of cooperative handling and the things that we can do within the veterinary clinic to enhance the patient experience, gosh, we're learning every single day just how integrated behavior is into day-to-day patient care, regardless of whether we ever schedule a behavior consult, if you will. And so I think in some cases, it's a lack of recognition. I think there's also a really valid challenge that a lot of our administrators have in that as the field grows and expands and we get so much knowledge coming through about all of the different modalities of diagnostic testing and treatment that are available to us, you know, guess what? We've still only got the 4 years of clinical education to try to cram all that information in. And so I worry that in some cases that we just don't have enough time within that four-year curriculum in order to cover everything that needs to be covered, from behavior to nutrition to, you know, oncology to internal medicine to surgical techniques and just all of these things. So I think in some cases, if people don't recognize the importance and they're feeling strapped for time by which to educate their students, behavior might get a little bit pushed out. I also think that there's a third concern, and that is, at least within the U.S., there's a relatively small number of board-certified clinicians who are in that position to share the knowledge with other students. And so if we're not available to teach, then those schools may be perhaps even saying, gosh, we'd like to include this, but we don't have someone on faculty already who is necessarily qualified to do that, which creates an additional hurdle for them. So there. I think there's a variety of really valid reasons why this doesn't, or why this hasn't been included as much as a core knowledge base as we would like it to be. I think there's a number of solutions that are coming down the pipeline to address that. As the college, the ACVB, as that college grows, obviously the availability of that information and the availability of services becomes greater, and that's absolutely going to help. I do think that in veterinary medicine right now, there's also a growing awareness of just how much of an impact behavior can have when we incorporate it within day-to-day patient care. And so that is just absolutely fueling the fire, as far as I'm concerned, for individuals wanting to incorporate that information into the education process.
Right. So firstly, we have recognition and that's, I guess, the same with any new ideas and concepts. It takes time for that stuff to filter through. And we have, once again, a universal thing, especially in 2018, and I'm sure it's going to be worse in 2028, is we're just bombarded with information and how do we find the time? So seemingly creativity is going to be our friend here. I do not have the answers. I can boldly say, sit on my podcast in my chair and say that, but I know it's not that easy. So Is it a question that as more people become aware of the importance of this, and one thing that could flow out of that is we save time moving forward when we have animals that are cooperating in our care? And then the question becomes, if that is true, I'm not saying it is, but if it is true, then what's the worst thing? You spending time learning it now or saving time for the next 20 years? I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I think that's a great way to look at it. And I think, you know, as you're talking about information overload and just so many things to take that do occupy our mental space, I think sometimes it's very easy to say, well, I don't have the time right here, right now, so I'm just going to keep doing what I've always done. And I know I've got examples of that in my own life outside of behavior where I've probably done exactly the same thing, where I've sort of triaged and say, I'll learn about that later, but right now I just have to get it done. So I don't want to fault anybody for making the decision that way, because I think we all do it. The challenge there is saying at what cost. And I think there are places where we can perhaps take those shortcuts. But when we're talking about the emotional experience of the animal, especially within the field of veterinary medicine, the at what cost really starts to add up. And I certainly have, within my patient population, and I know that colleagues would say the same thing, you know, we have patients that have sought out our care through their caregivers because of one or two traumatic experiences. And just like for people, one or two moments of severe trauma can be enough to completely change the way that your brain responds to those sensory stimuli and the way that it responds to those associated cues. And, you know, sometimes I think that in both in veterinary medicine as well as in other circumstances, we tend to downplay it because we say, well, oh, yep, you know, it's a veterinary clinic. The animals are going to be stressed. There's nothing we can do about that. It's just a part of life. And the reality is, especially for, let's say, you know, certain cats who become very, very stressed. And, you know, when I look at their medical records, I'm able to really see this progression from, you know, friendly kitten, outgoing personality to, you know, 6 months, 12 months later, a little bit timid, a little bit tentative, you know, and then perhaps there's a note of required additional restraint in order to give vaccines. And at some point, the animal says no. And they engage all of those defensive techniques, whether it's, you know, if we're talking about, you know, cats, for example, and we're talking about hissing or spitting or swatting or screaming or biting, or whether we're talking about dogs and it's growling and, you know, other defensive behaviors, we reach a critical threshold. And sometimes that is something that happens really from one or two bad experiences. And for me, when I think about the cost of that, it's not only the cost to the animal in terms of their own emotional experience, it's also the cost of not being able to provide that particular animal with high quality veterinary care from that point forward. And that is something that I hear my clients talking about over and over again, where perhaps we're dealing with, let's say, a two-year-old border collie who is difficult to handle at the veterinary clinic. And the client says, well, we're okay now because he or she is young and healthy, but what about, you know, 2 years, 4 years, 8 years from now? Or what if there was a traumatic incident and this dog needs extensive care? We're not going to be able to do it. So all of these things really start to come back into play, coming back to that balance of, do we learn it now or do we learn it later? The more we can learn now, the better equipped we are to maintain that patient experience such that we're not going to compromise our ability to provide quality patient care later on.
Yeah, beautifully said. And I think the behaviorists, the ABAs, and the people that have studied the fallout of aversion are sitting here going, yep, yep, yep. That is something that I might hypothesize would happen. Maybe I'll just put a shout out here, try to create more jobs for animal trainers. Maybe vet clinics need, you know, moving forward to consider, and maybe a conversation, there would be value. Oh, thanks for standing on my keyboard there, my cat. Maybe there would be value in having a conversation about the benefit of having separate behaviorists in vets, so that vets don't have to have that added pressure of learning about all the new medicines that are coming out and all the new studies on oncology and everything you mentioned mentioned before, and they can just pass that buck and delegate it to someone else. What do you think? I don't know.
You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity there that we're just starting to scratch the surface on. And for me, it's really a matter of collaboration. And when I think about all of the different skill sets that individuals have, you know, if we talk about someone who is, you know, a behavior consultant, or who, you know, approaches this from more of an applied behavior analysis perspective, or there's someone who's looking at it from the veterinary behavior perspective compared to the standard veterinarian, we all have a different lens that we're looking at this information through. And rather than saying my way is the right way, or this is the only way to look at this, we really all have something that we can learn from one another. And so those collaborations can be incredibly valuable in a way that allows everybody to maximize their input and do what they're most able to do without alienating or without missing big pieces of the puzzle. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity coming for those collaborations to really be a part of routine patient care.
Awesome. And I think we've just done a really great job in the last 10 minutes of giving insights into the conversation that's about to follow. Get little snippets of everything there. Just going back to your great Dane, and sorry to hear, I mean, I'm assuming this was a while ago, but still, I'm sorry to hear of the loss of your friend there. Do you have any stories from when you were first learning about your great Dane? What was your great Dane's name?
My great Dane's name was Phoebe.
And Phoebe, I'm grateful, my dog's to called say that Phoebe.
Really?
How do you spell it?
Phoebe. Although, ironically, my partner and I never agreed on whether it should be O-E or E-O. So depending on who wrote her name down on the admit papers, it was going to be one way or the other. So take your pick.
We have F-I-B-I and F, and that's what I spell her name as, and my partner spells her name as F, double E, B, double E. Anyway, on to your Phoebe, not my Phoebe.
Oh, no, it was great. I'm grateful to say that we had her just shy of 12 years. Which for a Dane is something that I'm truly, you know, truly grateful for. So, but I appreciate your thoughts. So with Phoebe, I would say that one of the things that I go back to a lot when I'm working with patients now is I try to remember all of those initial mistakes that I made. You know, as I learned and as my skill set improved, I remember thinking back to, you know, to some of those early training classes where my coordination was off and I was mixing up my cues, and she was looking at me completely and utterly confused because she had no idea what I was trying to communicate to her. And so I try to bring that empathy forward with my clients and recognize that for them, this is like learning a new language. And if I'm expecting them to be fluent and to be skilled, that's going to take time. So for me, I go back to some of those early lessons that she taught me as I was learning some of these details. And I remember, having moments where I just wanted to look at her and say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for making all those mistakes and, you know, getting frustrated with you, at you, with me, all of those things, because it can be really difficult in learning those, you know, not only just the techniques, but in really putting it into practical application. So she taught me a ton. And I would say that's something that I learned from almost every single patient, is there's something unique about the way in which that animal is responding to cues, or the impact that certain exercises are going to have on their overall behavior. And so I try to go into every single patient experience and every client experience as open as I possibly can be to say, what can I teach you and what can I learn from you that allows us both to move forward more effectively?
It's like learning a new language. Maybe that could be the title of this podcast episode. That's resonated with me because I don't speak another language and I've always found it challenging. It's one thing I've been challenged learning. And I could apply myself, obviously, but I can take that personal experience of myself now and put it onto the people that I interact with. So thank you for sharing that. I like that.
You're certainly welcome.
So bring us up to speed now, Chris, just before we move on. Tell us, build upon the intro, what you're doing now and where people can go to get in touch with you and find out more information.
So most of the work that I do really is routed through the practice that I have here in Portland, Oregon. And so it's the Animal Behavior Clinic. We are a practice that is specifically dedicated to helping clients with those behavior issues that they're having with their animals. And of course, we're collaborating with trainers and behavior consultants and veterinarians, as well as the pet owners. I also do a lot of work consulting both with shelters as well as doing a lot of lectures and continuing education opportunities. And so as of right now, the best place to go for information is either going to be through our website, animalbehaviorclinic.net, or through the Animal Behavior Clinic's Facebook page. And we try to do as good a job as we can of making sure that information is getting out there so that people can absorb it and find what's really going to resonate with them.
Awesome. And we will link to all of this in the podcast write-up. So if you wanted to easily find it, head to animaltrainingacademy.com, check the podcast link, find this episode. It'll be the latest one there, and you can find all the links there. We're going to move on now. And I really enjoy hearing about people's behavioral odysseys. So thank you very much for sharing all of that information. And what we talked about there was, and you said it really beautifully, you articulated it well, is that we have different levels of analysis when we're looking at behavior. And as is going to be clear to the people listening to this podcast, one of your main models, or your main model, I should say, is the medical model. So can you build upon everything you've just told us already, Chris? And for everyone listening, explain what looking at behavior through the medical model looks like, because I appreciate that the majority of the listeners of the show, and I may be wrong because I don't actually have this data, I'm hypothesizing here based on the people that I interact with, are probably coming from more of an applied behavior analytical perspective. So can you help these people take off their hats and put on your hat, put on your glasses for a while and bring us into your world?
Absolutely. Could be a little scary to get into my world sometimes, but I'll do the best I can. So the medical model for me is it's a couple of things. Number one, it's something that I didn't fully appreciate, and really didn't fully appreciate how it differentiates veterinary behaviorists and people who are approaching behavior from the veterinary perspective from these other disciplines up until probably the last couple of years, as I started doing more educating and working with, you know, trainers with a variety of backgrounds and listening to the questions that they were bringing forward and recognizing that we were actually looking at these scenarios from different angles based on our respective educations. So from that standpoint, that's a newer realization for me. And so it really put me back to saying, well, what is different about this? And why is this perspective unique? Recognizing that when I say unique, I'm not saying better, I'm not saying worse, I'm just saying different. It's a different lens than what a lot of people are used to thinking about. And so before I go into the behavior side of that, I'm going to rewind and really just look at the medical model as it relates to medical conditions. And we can make that really, really straightforward with something like an ear infection, or we can make it a lot more complicated and talk about something like, let's say, Cushing's disease. You know, if we're talking about, you know, either of those two medical conditions, there are behavior, there are symptoms clusters basically that go into that. So if we think about a dog with an ear infection, there's certain things that we look for. You know, perhaps the animal is showing signs of pain, or there might be redness or swelling or an abnormal odor, or the animal might be head shaking or displaying certain behavioral changes that go along with some of those physical changes. So if we look at otitis or ear infections, there's a certain set of things that we know go together. Now, would we automatically expect that a dog that has an ear infection is also going to be, let's say, urinating more frequently? No, those two things don't really go together. And so if we had a client who says, oh, he's shaking his head and he's peeing a lot, my brain says we probably have to look at two different things because there's not an immediate connection there. So we're, in some ways, we're looking for symptoms clusters to try to figure out what goes together and what doesn't. And so much of the veterinary curriculum is really focused on, you know, teaching which of these patterns are integrated with one another and how these body systems talk to one another and how this whole process works. And there's pros and cons to that, which I'll come back to. You know, and again, on a more complicated level, if we're talking about Cushing's disease, which is essentially basically an overproduction of steroid hormone within the body, there are certain things that we would expect to go along with that and certain things that we wouldn't. And so the medical model is really this ingrained process of asking clients really, really specific questions observing things within our physical exam and trying to pull that information together in such a way that we can move forward to a point of a diagnosis. Now, this is where I think some of the conversation surrounding the behavioral application of that medical model kind of takes us into some interesting territory. Because if we talk about what that does for me as a veterinary behaviorist, it may allow me to make a diagnosis of, let's say, fear-based aggression or separation anxiety. And that can very much look like we're now putting a label on top of this, you know, set of symptoms. And as we learn from, you know, brilliant minds like Susan Friedman and others within the applied behavioral analysis sector, labeling behaviors isn't necessarily helpful. So then that puts us into this conflict of saying, well, is it helpful to say separation anxiety or not? And for me, it's helpful, and there's a question there. It's helpful to a point because there are certain patterns that go together. There are certain things that we expect. And so if I know that, for example, 74% of dogs with separation anxiety do a specific thing, you know, that we're going to see a particular set of patterns or behaviors or a response to therapy, that allows me to jump forward into the treatment mode much more efficiently. But what I have to remember is that if 74% of dogs behave in a certain way, 26% do not. And so where I think the limitation of the label comes into play is that if I'm assuming that just because I've diagnosed a dog with separation anxiety, I therefore know everything about that animal's behavioral pattern, and I move forward with that assumption, I'm going to be off track because I'm going to miss something unique about that particular animal that probably is requiring me to adapt my techniques in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's where we get really into more of that concern about labeling, where we go too far into what we think that label tells us about the behavior. But yet for me, there is a benefit within there as long as I recognize the limitations of that. And then bringing us back around to that medical model, it allows me to piece all of those pieces together. And so the way that I at least put these things together, as I say, I get my history, I get my information, I look at my direct observations, see what makes the most sense, pinpoint some of those things that may be unique about that particular animal, and then move forward with our treatment plan. And if there's something that really, for whatever reason, just doesn't fit those symptoms, clusters that we're lumping into diagnoses or patterns, then for me, that's really where I actually then take off my hat and say, what would ABA tell me? If I didn't look for these symptoms clusters, but I looked instead at those antecedent conditions or the behavior that the animal is displaying, or what consequences might be ones that I can manipulate to achieve different outcomes, maybe I can move my medical model aside for a second and look at it a completely different way. So I think that there's definitely a complementary aspect for those as well as other models that are out there for assessing behavior, as long as we recognize sort of the advantages and the limitations of each of those techniques.
And we were saying before this podcast that Chris warned me that he might get up and start walking around while he was talking. And people always ask me, like, hey, are we going to be sharing a video? And sometimes I wish we could, because Chris, you're extremely animated and it aids the story. And it's like you're doing a little dance as you're talking to me. It's wonderful. Just wanted to put you in there that I appreciate you, and I appreciate that
ever do get to the point of doing video, there's almost always jazz hands in my presentations as well. So the song and dance aspect definitely comes into play.
We have to bring all the different parties together, right, and collaborate. So we'll bring some jazz into what we do. It's gonna resonate with some people. It's gonna help us around this. So you use clusters. You get information from the clients. You get information from your own observations in that limited space that you have, which is out of the context of your dogs potentially being around other dogs or being left at home by itself. It's in the clinic. So you're taking that information and you're using clusters from your experience to kind of say, you know, there's a 74% chance right now that this is going on. So let's form a plan based on that, because we're all humans. We don't have time to visit our clients' houses and set up cameras and do everything that's required to get all the information. But you realize the limitations in this. You realize that there's 26% of dogs or whatever animal doesn't fit in that cluster, doesn't fit in that definition of whatever that definition is, fear-based aggression, separation anxiety. So Moving forward, and with other vets, what percentage of people, I know you don't know that, do you think are kind of like just relying on clusters? Does that happen? And what do we need to know as people taking our animals to vets with regards to being ABAers? And because I'm assuming that if we don't know this, if we don't realize those limitations, and we're not paying attention, and we are using labels, fear-based aggression, that can really prohibit us as vets, as clients, in paying attention to those antecedents and those consequences, which might be the more prevalent piece of information. So what advice can you give we're probably speaking more to clients and to vets. Obviously, if you're a vet and you're listening to this, I appreciate that. I don't mean to sideline you 100%. So maybe speak to both. What advice can you give moving forward? Because you're saying that you realize the limitations, but we've acknowledged kind of at the start of this podcast, potentially lots of people don't realize it.
Yeah, I think it's a great distinction to make. And I guess one of the themes that comes through for me more often than almost any other, and this is going to come true whether I'm working with an animal, whether I'm working with a client, whether I'm working with a veterinarian or a veterinary student, really whoever I am communicating with, my goal is to meet them where they are and then figure out what it means to move them forward. And so to bring that into what you're talking about here is, you know, if I'm talking about a client, you know, let's say it's the pet owner themselves, they know that animal probably better than anybody else does. So if my goal is to meet them where they are, I need to try to tap into their knowledge about their animal. And there are some tricks to really getting that done effectively and efficiently, for sure. But that would be, you know, things that I can pull into that conversation. If I'm working with the animal directly, again, am I going to get stuck on the fact that this is a dog who is, showing fear-based aggression, or am I in that moment going to be watching body language? And am I going to be watching how that animal responds to the communication or the interaction or the environment that they're in? And so I think for me, it's in either of these cases or in any of them, really, it's really about not losing sight of the forest for the trees, or vice versa, that the label can be helpful to a particular part or a particular portion, but we never want to lose sight, as you said, of the ABA, of the antecedent conditions or the behavior. We don't want to lose sight of that in the process. And if we are working with anybody, whether that's the veterinarian or the trainer or behavior consultant or the owner, we're all going to have knowledge gaps, every single one of us. And so if we're able to even just start by acknowledging where those limitations are, then we can figure out, you know, how do we collaborate together more effectively in order to move this whole process forward. And I know that that's really general, but there's so much individual nuance that has to go into every single conversation in order to figure out truly what is needed for this owner or this animal or this veterinarian. And so speaking about it more in general concepts, I find to be a little bit helpful until we can really dive into those specifics.
I like that. And I think it's a nice reminder, and something I've learned along the way is that the person in front of you who works with that animal every day, who lives with that animal, knows more about that animal than you do, regardless of what level of analysis and your experience and knowledge and background and all that stuff. So thank you for adding that in there. And also acknowledging and something that I'm more and more aware of every month as the host of this podcast show and runner of Animal Training Academy is my knowledge gaps, because they're big and they're vast. And I wish I could fill them, but I don't. So we have people like Chris to come and help out with that. So great information there. One more thing, just before we move on, because you started to talk about, you've talked about it numerous times actually already, and you're just starting to go, I think, down that rabbit hole just then as well, is the importance of community. So we're going to talk about this next and how we can build this. Before we do that, you talked about how you use your clusters, come up with a diagnosis based on that, put it to action, but you don't lose sight of the limitations of that label. And you know then yourself when to take off your ABA hat, sorry, your medical hat, and put on your applied behavior analysis hat or whatever other hat you want to put on. Let's reverse that. And maybe you can speak to the people who are going into the vet or wherever they're going wearing their ABA hat. When does it become appropriate, or at what point, or how should we, do we change hats as ABA practitioners or whatever other level of analysis?
That's a great question. And I think that I'm going to almost rephrase that a little bit and say, when is it most appropriate to, you know, let's say trade the ABA for the medical hat versus when is it appropriate to really engage that collaboration with someone who has the other hat on? And the reason I want to rephrase it that way is that, and this is one of these things that just within these last few years really hit me over the head, is that it, unless you've gone through an entire veterinary or medical curriculum and have developed this ability of how to think about all of these different clusters in all of these different ways, it's really difficult, if not impossible, to really be able to do that well. And so I think unless someone truly is trained as a medical professional, the likelihood of them being able to take off an ABA hat and put on a medical hat is almost impossible. And I say that not in any way to question the intelligence or the skill level or any of those things. Many of the people that I know who are doing really tremendous behavioral consulting work are more than qualified to go through that education, and they'd be amazing at it, but they haven't done it yet. And so that's where the collaboration piece really comes into play for me, is as a behavioral professional to be able to say, effectively, this is what I'm seeing. This is what's in front of me. And how do I communicate that, let's say, to a veterinary professional? Now, ineffectively, that might come across as saying, this dog is gaining weight and its hair coat is of really poor quality. You should test this dog for thyroid disease. That's probably not the most effective way to get that point across. You know, on the other hand, if we said, you know, as a behavior consultant or a behavior analyst, this is what I've noticed. Despite appropriate exercise, the dog's weight has continued to increase. The client is reporting that, you know, these are the behavior changes that they are seeing. We have implemented changes to address that from a behavior perspective, but we're not seeing the change in behavior that we would normally expect to see for the vast majority of the clients and the animals that we work with. Is it possible that there's something more here to the medical picture that we just haven't uncovered yet? And are you open to a conversation surrounding what that might look like? You know, something along those lines where we can say, rather than trying to step in and tell someone else what they should or shouldn't be doing, let's leverage our own experiences. And I'm going to rephrase this too, from both sides of the coin. If you're someone who's approaching this from the ABA model, really leverage your skill set and tell that veterinarian what it is that you're seeing and why you're concerned, because that's the information that's going to allow them to figure out what are the systems clusters that actually go together and which ones don't. And if you're on the veterinary side, if you're working with a patient and you say, I'm going to use just a very generic example, the animal is brought in by their owner who's complaining about anxiety or aggression, and the veterinarian puts the animal onto their medication of choice, and the animal's not responding, then it's the veterinarian's responsibility to be able to say, from my medical model, I need to leverage the help of someone who really understands the behavior side of this. And so who is the behavior professional that I can seek out to be able to do that hands-on work with the client and to really investigate what this animal needs from a behavior training or behavior modification perspective to be able to leverage that? So it's not about, again, saying that one is better or worse. It's that they're unique skill sets, and we get the best results when we're collaborating with really effective communication and allowing everybody to do what they're really, really good at for the benefit of the patient.
Fantastic. Let's continue now to build on that and just want to acknowledge what you said there. It's not saying that one model is better or worse. And I think it was Linda Ryan a few podcast episodes ago who said that we're all the same under the hat. Put different hats on, but we're all the same under the hat. So it's important to remember that. And thank you for reminding us of that. So let's move forward. That was so much fun to learn about it. But let's talk about developing these relationships that you've been referring to. As a client, developing a relationship with our vets. As a vet, developing relationships with our clients. And I think these were your words. And the importance of community when managing our animals' behavioral health and the rest of their health. Can you please speak to this, the importance of community?
Absolutely. Community is such an important thing. I mean, just if we're talking about people for, you know, specifically here, moving away from the animals for just a second, community is an absolutely vital part of this. Nobody is ever by themselves going to have all of the skills, all of the knowledge, all of the details, all of the everything that they need to be successful in all things. So we really have to have those collaborative relationships in order to be successful, you know, just at a basic level. When it comes to the behavior stuff specifically, you know, I think the challenge and the struggle that I hear more often than any other is, how do I go about creating these relationships? And I hear this both from veterinarians who are in some cases bombarded with trainers or behavior consultants, you know, stopping by with, you know, a gift of food or chocolate and a bunch of brochures and business cards. And the veterinarians may not have the knowledge to really sort out who is the individual they should perhaps be collaborating with. And then I find that for, you know, the behavior consultant, they're working with a variety of clients who are seeing a variety of different veterinarians at a bunch of different veterinary clinics. And so I think from both perspectives, the individual as the veterinarian or the individual as the behavior consultant, you're trying to navigate all of these relationships at the same time. And it's really overwhelming unless we can figure out how do we create inroads. And so depending on who I'm talking to at the time, I try to help those individuals identify what would be an effective way to forge those relationships, ideally before they're needed. And that for me is a big important piece. If I've got a, let's say I'm a veterinarian and I've got a dog that comes in to see me and that owner is in crisis and they need help today, I don't have the time right then and there to interview and to figure out who's going to be the best fit. I need to have those names right there, right in front of me. You know, and similarly, if I'm a behavior consultant and I recognize that there's more going on for this particular animal than what I'm going to be able to address, I need to be able to have an effective communication strategy for getting them back to their veterinarian to address that other piece in a complementary way. So I think we can look at that from either angle, whether it's, you know, teaching veterinarians what are two or three questions to ask of someone who wants you to refer to them, that we can understand perhaps what methods they're using or how they might interact with our clients so that we can make sure that this is an appropriate referral. And on the behavior consultant side, we may be able to really focus on the communication, as I was sort of alluding to before. How do we take that information that we already know about those antecedent conditions or the behaviors that we've observed, and how do we prepare that in a way that makes sense to the veterinarian so that they can actually benefit from all of that and recognize that, wow, this individual has a tremendous skill set that could be really useful for us. And that's what starts to create those relationships that we can then depend on for additional clients, for additional animals in the future.
So what kind of information do you think vets are after from behavior consultants? I mean, is it black and white? Is it simple, like, let's just show them what we do? Is that what you're saying? Or is there extra information you think that that people listen to this podcast who may be in that position can take to their vets to help forge that relationship?
Yeah, I think if we're talking about an individual, you know, case, for example, I think it's a little bit easier to get into specifics. I think that for many veterinarians, they don't really have the time or the interest to read a 7-page behavior plan. And even if they have the interest, they may not have the knowledge to tease out what is most important. And so if someone is working as a behavior consultant, I think one of the best things they can possibly do, well, two things. One is break it down into the bullet point form, something that's relatively easily digestible that really puts either the question or the information right up front and center and really putting it out there for the veterinarian to consider. So I think that's part of it. The flip side of that that goes along with that is asking the question, truly asking the question, what is the best way for me to get this information to you? I think we often communicate with others in sort of our default, which for many of us might be email, for example, or we've written up this beautiful behavior change plan for our clients. We think, oh my gosh, I'm just going to fax or email that over to the clinic, and that's going to tell them everything they would possibly need to know about this animal, and I've done my job, and there you go. And the reality is, you know, if this is a veterinarian who perhaps is trying to see patients every 15 minutes because of the limitations they have within their own practice, that behavior change plan, although beautiful, is never going to get integrated into their overall assessment. It's just not possible. And so, you know, asking the question, if you're a behavior consultant and you want that information to get to the right individual, ask the question, call the clinic, email them, whatever the communication is that they've listed either on their website or that you know how to communicate, and say, hey, I've got some information that relates to the work that I've been doing with so-and-so and their animal. What's going to be the best way for me to get that information to the vet for them to consider? How would they like to receive that information? And if I were working as a behavior consultant trying to create those relationships, I would probably have a spreadsheet in front of me that I would say, Dr. Johnson at, you know, this particular clinic prefers the information coming in this way. So I can really be efficient with that as I'm building that relationship, and I'm really taking that little extra step, which quite honestly doesn't have to take very long, to get the information to that individual in a way that allows them to incorporate it. What I love about that is that that also allows that individual to recognize the value of the information that I'm giving to them, which means they're more likely to reach out for additional collaboration later on. And so if I'm looking at it from either of those perspectives, we're forming an effective conversation, truthfully.
So physically asking the person, what is the best way for you that I can get this information to you?
Yeah.
They're saying, this is how I would like to receive it. Now I'm going to send it to you, and you should be the same.
Right. And we make all those assumptions, right? I mean, we do the same thing with our clients. We do the same things with animals. Hey, I've taught 17 dogs to sit using this method. Let me do the same thing here. And then we fall flat on our face because the dog in front of us learns or receives information differently. So we have to be able to adapt. That doesn't mean that we have to, you know, reinvent the wheel every time over. We might even make that more efficient by asking the receptionist or the client care representative at that clinic to say, hey, this is how I would normally present that information. Will that be received well by your doctors? Because if it is, honest, you know, we just saved ourselves a ton of time by being able to do that. But it comes down to asking the question and phrasing the question in a way that leads the conversation in a direction that is going to work for everybody, which is a sort of a separate skill in and of itself, but very much an important part.
Yeah, and you got to think about it, and it ties back to things we're talking about earlier, I think, in that if you put time and effort and energy into communication and it doesn't get results, then you've wasted that time and energy. So if you put time and energy into learning about the animal in front of you, the animal being the vet, because we're animals, and how they learn and how they interact with their environment, i.e. a training plan you send them, you're going to save time down the track.
Absolutely.
Hopefully you'll be reinforced for that behavior.
Yes, ideally, at least intermittent positive reinforcement. You're going to get something out of it. Absolutely.
Great information. And I know for the people listening to the show, this is going to be highly beneficial. Now I was hoping we could build on this even more and talk about what you called respective, effective communication skills with clients. So we're talking about the vets now, aren't we?
Yeah, you know, for me, the client, you know, I sort of use that term almost universally, you know, at least I'm able to apply that, because in some cases, the client is the veterinarian. In some cases, the client is the pet owner. In some cases, my client is, you know, the facilities manager at a particular shelter. You know, so for me, the client is whoever my point of entry happens to be for creating that behavior change plan. And so the communication that I have with that individual has to do a couple of things. I have to be able to get information from that individual in a way that I can then interpret it and figure out what to do with that information. And so that's questioning, it's body language observation skills, it's engaging in a conversation almost like a little dance, where if I'm working, let's say, with an animal in the room and I move my my body in a particular way, how does the animal respond? That tells me something. So, you know, we have to have these conversations, whether it's verbally, whether it's body language, whether it's with the client and the vet and the dog. And there's all of these different variables, and it can very easily start to become overwhelming if we're trying to think about all of these individual things. And so I try to break it down into some of the more simple details that we can apply more universally. One of them I mentioned before, which is meeting the individual where they are. You know, let's say I'm working with an animal and I'm thinking this is an animal who needs, you know, X, Y, and Z, you know, this complicated, you know, sequence of behavior chains, and the animal doesn't know how to sit on cue yet. I need to meet that animal where it is versus diving into the more elaborate details. And that's going to be true if I'm talking with a veterinarian or the client. I have to figure out what are the building blocks that they need in order to be able to make sense of something that's perhaps a bit more complicated or more in depth. So meeting them where they are is part of that effective communication. It also comes down to asking questions in a way that allows the client to give me the information that I most need. So if I ask the client, for example, you know, let's say they've got a dog who is lunging at other dogs on leash, just as an example. And I ask the client, you know, tell me what happens when you go for a walk. And if the client is, you know, going off into a story or is describing, well, and he gets really mad and then he's really upset and he can't calm himself down, and they're kind of using a lot of interpretive words, that actually doesn't give me any data. Now, if I ask the client, what is the stimulus threshold, or what is the point along the stimulus gradient at which your dog's, you know, exceeds its threshold capacity or whatever, you know, it's mumbo jumbo to the client. So it's sort of combining those two things, not necessarily letting the client kind of run off and give me a lot of descriptions that doesn't mean anything. And it's also not getting so technical that the client can't answer my questions. And it's sort of finding this fine line of how to ask the questions in a way that allows the client to be successful. So if the client, again, is saying, gosh, my dog gets really mad and he's lunging and he's barking and he's doing all these things, I might tell the client something along the lines of, pretend for a second that I don't know anything about animal behavior, and you're describing to me in as much detail as you possibly can about what your dog looks like right at the moment where you start to kind of lose his focus. What does he look like? And what I'm checking with that is not only sort of what are the actual observations that are going to tell me something about the animal, I'm also getting information about what that client's skill set is. How observant are they? What are they seeing? Are they able to report that back to me? And then if I start adding in some additional information, oh, this body language means this, or this is what that tells me, are they able to incorporate that information and really start adding more detail to the conversation or not? And so it's figuring out, what does this conversation need to look like in order to truly be effective? And what I'm thinking about is, as we all know, we don't walk into a particular interaction with a client or an animal, snap our fingers, and immediately fix the problem. These relationships are going to be ongoing. And so what I'm trying to figure out when I'm with these conversations and with this effective communication is not only how do we accomplish something right here, right now, but how do I learn how this particular client or animal communicates so that I can be more effective as we move forward in this relationship, you know, and work through these details. So this is all, you know, a big part of, you know, this sort of respectful, effective communication that for me is a lot more about how we do what we do than it is about what we do. And whether I'm talking with veterinarians or clients or behavior consultants, I hear so many examples of people who say, oh, well, I did this and then it didn't go the way I thought it was going to go. And when we really tease out the details of that conversation or that communication, they may have actually provided really good solid information, but they either missed a detail because they didn't get quite all of the information they needed, or they didn't present it to the client or the animal in a way that it could actually be received and elicit an actual change in behavior. So part of what we're teasing out with all of this is figuring out, what does everybody need to make progress and to move forward?
So it's kind of, with some of the stuff you're saying there, example of something that I've heard referred to as the curse of knowledge. And you're using the metaphor of a dance. So let's stick with that. So it's like going to dance with someone and you are a professional salsa dancer and the person's got two left feet and you just come in and go, come on, let's go, do this, left to the right, to the left, to the... I don't salsa dance, obviously, for the salsa dancers out there. But like, so we got to kind of figure out where their dance skills are. Is this metaphor helpful? I don't know. Riffing off the top of my head.
You know, I think it is, you know, and that's something that I try to do, you know, even when I'm meeting a client for the first time, is that I may ask them to do something super simple and see, again, are they able to do it? It may have nothing to do with anything that we're focusing on, but I may even just be testing the client's ability to follow instructions. Can they do that right here, right now? Okay, yes or no. You know, or I might, in some cases, give them just a little bit more of a complicated instruction pattern than what I think they can handle, because I'm trying to figure out where is that line. And so that for me is all actually a part of the interview process to figure out, is this a client, let's say, and I'm not going to pick on engineers here, but I will a little bit. You know, I had a number of clients who are engineers or are in sort of that type of work. And for many of those individuals, they need all 37 steps of the behavior change plan with the contingencies for what we're going to do at step 22 if something seems a little bit off. And once they feel like they've got that entire big picture in front of them, now they're ready to get started. And if I tried to just get started without giving that picture, they're going to fight me every step along the way because they don't know where they're going. Versus many of my clients, I think this is, comes back to that curse of knowledge that you were mentioning, they really just need move your left foot here. And they need something so incredibly simple, but because we want to help and because we have all of this knowledge available to us, we say, oh my gosh, first you're going to move your left foot and then you're going to move your right foot and then you're going to move them back and forth and you're going to spin and you're going to twirl and you're going to, and all of a sudden the client doesn't kind of know what's going to happen, again, using the dance analogy. And so I think that part of what we're trying to do in order to be effective behavior analysts or, you know, behavior consultants or veterinary behaviorists for that matter, is figuring out how do we get the right level of information to the client, to the animal, to the individual, so that they can take those next steps forward along that path that they're on, either for that very specific issue or in the big picture. But I think that's where the dance analogy really comes into play, is that everybody's going to learn how to dance just a little bit differently. And everybody's going to look a little bit awkward the first time they try to do it. And, you know, and that could take this conversation in a whole different direction, is how are we supporting either our patients or the animal that we're working with or our clients through those awkward steps so that they get some short wins, they get some really immediate successes, they start to get a little bit more confidence and they're ready to move forward with the rest of the steps versus getting overwhelmed and saying, I'm never going to be a dancer and I just have to, you know, accept this particular scenario. Now, obviously I'm starting to mix some of the metaphors a little bit, but it's all a part of the communication process. It's not just about, do I have the information that might be helpful to this client? It's, can I get them the right information that allows them to accomplish what they want?
And take a full circle. If I had a dollar for every time I said that in this podcast show, then I would have like $10, maybe. I'd be wealthy. Take a full circle. So we're talking to our clients and we're giving them potentially little tests, seeing how good they are at dancing. And then we can form a cluster in our mind. Okay, this is how this person responds to information. Let's form a plan to help them be successful with their animal moving forward. Here it is. Then we have to still realize the limitations of that. And I say this because I'm thinking of the dancing metaphor. My dancing skills are about as good as my second language skills. They don't exist. But I had, at one point in time, a friend who taught me a little bit of salsa. So I could shuffle to the left and I could shuffle to the right and I could move back and I could just do those repetitively. And I showed those to some people and they're like, whoa, you're real good at dancing. I'm like, yeah, not really. I just know one or two things. So what I'm saying is, if somebody saw that, they might cluster me and like, okay, cool, that person knows how to dance. But the skill comes in still knowing the limitations of that. Like you said, we're mixing metaphors here.
Yes.
But I wanted to add that in there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point. And something else that just popped into my head when you were describing that, for you, and here I'm like, okay, so now we're really mixing. Okay, so if we're saying you as the dancer versus the client who bring their animal in for behavioral help, if you just wanted to, you know, feel like you didn't look like a complete idiot on the dance floor, that little bit of shuffling to the left and a little bit of shuffling to the right, maybe that's all you need. And you never need to be a better dancer in order to live a completely happy life. Same thing is true for our clients. You know, if we've got that client who brings the dog in and the dog is lunging and barking, or, you know, is you know, fill in the blank, whatever the behavior problem happens to be, not every client wants to become a professional trainer. Not every client wants that dog to be the social butterfly that can go everywhere and do everything. You know, that maybe for that client, just having a dog who can walk comfortably next to their owner on the opposite side of the street from a calm dog, maybe that's good enough, sort of the equivalent of shuffling a little to the left and shuffling a little to the right. And if we can help that client meet that level of success, then we've done our job. And even if we might walk away thinking, gosh, there's so much more we could do this and we could do that. And if I can just get the client on board, maybe they don't need that. And so if we're really trying to be effective, part of that is figuring out what level of skill is needed either for the animal or the individual in order to define this as a successful outcome. And that's going to allow us to really pinpoint what do we need to do within our plan that allows us to accomplish that.
I feel like we've explained this well to people, I hope. It feels good. I like the metaphors that we've used.
Good. It resonates. It's a little complicated sometimes, but I think it's all helpful. Everybody's going to hear the information just a little bit differently, so hopefully we've put it out there well enough.
Yeah, but I also realize that I'm going, this resonated with me, therefore it's going to resonate with everyone. There could be, you know, everyone in the audience going, what the heck are Ryan and Chris on about?
Dancing? What?
I thought this was an animal training podcast. Anyway, looking at the time, I've got a ton more questions, and I know there were a few more things that we wanted to talk about, but let's move on in the interest of time. Once again, if I had a dollar for every time I said that in the podcast episode, we are sadly nearly at the end, but that's okay because this is one of my favorite parts of the podcast show. Chris, I love stories. Can you share with everyone listening two or three stories from your experience, considering all the things we've talked about today and some of the important lessons these have taught you?
Oh, absolutely. And this is where I get to say, if I had a dollar for every little nugget that I've learned from a client over the years, I also would be incredibly wealthy. You know, one of the ones that comes to mind for me that I try to carry into almost every consult is I try to remember that I can't predict what a client is going to do until they've done it. And what that really means for me is that, you know, there's an example, this was some years ago, I had a gentleman come in with a dog, and it's been long enough that I've forgotten some of the real specifics of the case, but it was a young dog, high energy breed, you know, and one of the things that we assessed as being insufficient for this particular dog was to exercise. And, you know, and the gentleman came in to see me in a motorized cart, very limited function of his legs, you know, variety of health conditions, inactive lifestyle, all of these things that for me were distinct obstacles. And when I looked at this individual's behavior in the past and asked them questions, I thought, gosh, there's just no way that this person is going to do this. And they didn't have the funds to be able to, you know, invest in dog walkers or some of the other creative solutions that sometimes we can leverage in those situations. And I thought, you know what? I don't think we're going to get there. You know, we need this particular piece of the puzzle, and I just don't think it's going to happen. And we kept the behavior plan relatively simple, including exercise on there. And he said, yep, I'll do it. I thought, myself, it's never going to happen. And he came back about 3-4 weeks later, and he had his little journal in front of him. He's like, yep, and this day we did 4 miles, and this day we did 7. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, this is important to me. You told me I needed to make it happen. It wasn't important for me to do the work. It was important for me to do the work for this animal. And I'll be darned if he didn't absolutely blow my expectations out of the water. And I've learned that on both sides of the coin, where sometimes I think there's no way that this client is going to be successful or this animal is going to really succeed. And they absolutely do. In other cases, I look at perhaps a behavior plan and I think, gosh, this looks super simple. There's no way this could fail. Well, yeah, sometimes it does. So I'm never going to, I really try not to predict what they're going to do until they've done it, because that's really the test of what's of what the outcome is going to be. You know, and I learned that not only through cases like that one, but I remember a client, gosh, this is probably going back 13, 14 years at this point, very early on in my behavior career. And it was a client that I was working with. I forget what the behavior issue was, but their level of understanding, shall we say, of dog training was very basic. They were using punitive, corrective, physical measures. And, you know, we worked through the plan and, you know, taught them some new techniques. And I just wasn't sure where the plan was going to go, and whether they were going to embrace the information that I had given them. And they were making some progress, actually quite a bit of progress. And unfortunately, the animal passed away very suddenly. And while I was kind of debriefing with the client about what had happened, you know, she was able to look back on the changes they had made, was able to see the difference in the comfort, the joy, the demeanor of that animal based on those changes we had made, and was able to feel really grateful for having done it. And we never would have had that had we not incorporated these techniques, had we not, you know, tried to solve this a different way. And, you know, and I remember, you know, having that conversation with her, and she was in tears and I was in tears. And for me at that point, I could have looked at that situation and said, gosh, there's so much more that we could have done if we had started earlier, if we had done this or we had done that. And yet for that particular case, it was everything it needed to be. And so for me, you know, it's a case that I often reflect back on when I sometimes wonder, as we all I suspect we all do, when we're really busy, when we're overwhelmed, and we're sometimes wondering, are we actually making a difference? The difference that we make for the individuals as well as for the overall community is huge. And so I try to reflect back on some of those times where clients have shared that information with me when I'm struggling to figure out what are we doing here. Yeah, that's just one of the examples where I can say that very, very confidently.
Well, I was getting all emotional listening to that. We call that creating ripples at Animal Training Academy. And the idea being that sometimes you pick up a big fat boulder and you throw it in the water and it creates a lot of disturbance. And sometimes you just throw little people in. But everything that you're doing is to put that information out there and to do your best to help is creating ripples that flow out. They flow. They don't stop there. They flow like ripples. I'm doing hand movements now. So if you can all see me, I realize you can't. But imagine ripples. And the lesson from story one is just have zero expectations. I'm joking, Chris. but just be conscious of and recognize the value in appreciating your expectations. Yeah. Does that sum it up?
It is. Yeah. For me, it's I like little catchphrases. They're quick for me to remember. And for me, it's detaching from expectations. It's not being so attached to what I think the outcome is going to be that I lose sight of the stuff that's happening along the way. So detaching from expectations is what sort of keeps me grounded for each step of the process with a client.
Yeah. The journey is the destination.
The journey is the destination. Absolutely.
I love it. We obviously did not fail to disappoint with those great stories and lessons. Sadly, though, getting a bit sad at the end here with stories, and also because we are heading towards the final question. And for this one, Chris, could you please now take us all into the future and share with us what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training world? But let's additionally maybe ask what you would like to see happen in the medical model level of analysis and incorporating behavior change strategies that might be from other hats wearing individuals.
Yeah. You know, for me, that fast forward look into the future is, this may sound a little bit familiar even because we've talked about some of these ideas already in the conversation today, but it's, I think for me, the future is one that involves effective collaborations between those individuals. So it's not what do I think is happening on the veterinary side and what do I think is happening on the training side. I look forward to a point when we're really recognizing, you know, trainers and behavior consultants truly as paraprofessionals within the veterinary industry, and those lines of communication are open, and people are learning and are understanding how to communicate that information effectively across those different fields. Because when we're able to do that, when we will be able to be to do that effectively, everybody wins. In 5 to 10 years, exactly. Everybody wins. I mean, everybody in that process, the veterinarians get to see more patients because they're not taking time doing things they're not really perhaps interested in or very good at. The behavior consultants get to help more people because the referrals are coming in maybe even faster they can get to them. Ultimately, it's the animal that benefits from having that team approach. And it's really, I think, embracing and learning how to embrace the individual skill sets of every member of the team that is going, I think, to move us forward to that next level. Because I think if, you know, it doesn't really matter what's happening for me in the veterinary behavior world or in the veterinary world, if that information is not also crossing over to trainers and behavior consultants and behavior analysts. And it doesn't, to some degree, doesn't matter how much of an advancement we see within those other fields if we don't find a way to incorporate that into veterinary care as well. We've got to be able to advance this side by side. And that's what I look forward to happening in the next 5 to 10 years.
I'm going to sum that up in 5 words.
If you've learned one thing about me during this podcast, it's that 5 words, and it's tough. That's a tough one for me.
How about find and build your tribe?
That works for me.
Awesome. That resonates with ATA audience as well. That's why I wanted to stick it in there. So all of that was absolutely amazing. Resonating with the ATA audience is something that occurred through this full last hour and a bit, I think. So thank you so much for sharing everything today, Chris, for taking the time today to work out technology before we went live, for doing the podcast, for connecting with me a month ago and having a chat from a cafe or wherever you were on your run that day, and for shooting messages back and forth over the last wee while. So thank you for all the time thus far that you've invested in creating this piece of content so we can create some ripples out there in the community. Thank you very much.
You're absolutely welcome, Ryan. I appreciate the opportunity, and this has been a ton of fun for me as well. I look forward to seeing where the energy of those ripples comes back to us again, because I know that it will.
Awesome. And one last time, just before we wrap up, tell everyone listening where they can go to find out more about what you're up to and get in touch.
Sure. The animalbehaviorclinic.net is the practice website. And then if you're on Facebook or social media, predominantly Facebook, the Animal Behavior Clinic site for Portland, Oregon, is where you're going to find information. And that would be the best places for now.
Fantastic. And as mentioned earlier, I will link to all of that in the podcast write-up on animaltrainingacademy.com as well. We do, of course, really appreciate all of you out there tuning in today. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you are interested in carrying on this and other conversations about working with our animals in the most positive, the funnest, the choice richest ways, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening, everyone, and you will hear from us again soon. Farewell.